From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Yesterday, we celebrated All Saints Day, and that's one of my favorite feast days in our Catholic Church. Of course, we talk a lot about saints and future saints, those people on the path to sainthood. But November 1st is the day when we celebrate all the saints. Do you know how many saints there are? There's something like 10,000, at least that's the rough estimate that I've seen. So big day for saints, and we've got the exact expert on saints to talk to us on today's program. That's Meg Hunter-Kilmer. She's got this new book series that's out. She had this award-winning book, Saints Around the World, but now it's kind of an offshoot book or a derivative book, a set of books called Saints Around the World for Little Ones. It's a collection from St. Paul Center, and really beautifully done, beautifully illustrated, and I'll be excited to talk to Meg about saints. She's truly an expert. And later in the show, we'll be doing part two of an interview with Father Robert Spitzer. You all know him from EWTN, and he's the author of Christ, Science, and Reason, What Can We Know About Jesus, Mary, and Miracles? And we'll be continuing that conversation about science and miracles, and hopefully we'll touch on Eucharistic miracles in part two of this interview with he's an expert, of course, in his own way on that intersection of faith and science. Check out my series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, Pere Lemoniel, that airs on the 16th of November at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. It's one of my favorite episodes where I visit Pere Lemoniel in France, where St. Margaret Mary Ellicoque, she first experienced dramatic visions of Jesus' Sacred Heart, and I explore the origins of this cherished devotion. Of course, Pope Francis himself very recently just released an encyclical about the Sacred Heart. So the timing is just perfect for that one. So check that one out, November 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, Explore with the Miracle Hunter. And on my other program, They Might Be Saints, we look at the life of Montse Grasses. We look at the saintly life of Montse Grasses, who was a cheerful 17-year-old who faced cancer with extraordinary faith and joy and could be the first woman of Opus Dei to be declared a saint. So check that one out. That's coming up on Wednesday, and that's at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Later in the show, we'll be looking at the might-be saint of the day like we always do. For today's date, we've got Blessed Luigi Campidello from Italy, of course, from 1868 to 1889. And the 365 Days with Mary project for today, November 2nd, we've got Our Lady of the Souls from Rome in Italy in the year 1550. And the question of the week, do you consider the end of the Washington Commander-Chicago Bears game a miracle? Well, that's a tough one for a Bears fan to answer that one, but I'll do my best to talk about miracles in sports later in the program. And the might-be saint of the day, today is the anniversary of Padre Pio's beatification miracle. We'll tell you all about that one that set him on the path to sainthood. Let's take a look at miracle news. We do this every week. We're talking about miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. You can go to my Facebook page and click on the link for this one. There's an apparition of Mary being claimed in this place called Masindi. And believers, especially particularly from the Catholic faith, are flocking to this place called Masindi following the reports of the Virgin Mary. And the visionaries claim that the Mother of Jesus urged couples who are cohabitating to sanctify their unions with holy matrimony, calling for repentance and prayers for that nation. And the Catholic diocese there in Hoima has advised caution as the church carefully discerns the authenticity of these reported visions. And rumors of the Virgin Mary's appearance began circulating 3 weeks ago. And Amangozima, the Ruwenza village chairman, is believed to be the first to witness the apparition while he was herding cattle. And according to Gozima, he saw a woman dressed in white with a blue striped collar who looked at him without speaking. And Gozima recounted, "I was afraid to share what I saw, but when another woman claimed a similar encounter 2 days later, I decided to speak up, and news of the apparition spread quickly, drawing crowds to the site." Brenda Tuhaise, who had camped at Ruwenza Hill for 2 weeks, shared her experience, saying that she saw the Virgin Mary on three occasions. And she said, first she was alone, and later alone again, and she spoke to me, told me to bring my husband and removed a charm from our troubled home. And the Huima Diocese Communication Director, Father Patrick Musavini, he urged caution. Quote, many people are coming with different accounts, some to see her with babies, other with a cloud. We're still discerning these visions, Father Musavini said. And we have not yet received confirmation from any church leaders, but we continue to shepherd those in lead, end quote. It's evidence from Masindi, the vicariate, it aligns with these reports. The bishop could forward a request to the papal nuncio, who could present to the pope to consider this as a pilgrimage site. So far, the only recognized Vatican apparition in Africa is Our Lady of Kabeho in Rwanda, who appeared from 1981 to 1989, foretelling the country's bloodshed if her message of repentance was ignored. And, of course, this has become a holy town, Our Lady of Kabeho. And so that's the news. Check that one out. These new Marian apparitions that are being claimed in Masindi. And we'll let you know what the Catholic Church says about these when an investigation, if any, commences. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week. We ask a trivia question, give out a prize to an emailer that writes in with the fastest with the correct answer. Last week, the question we were talking about Halloween, of course. Hope you all had a happy Halloween and you celebrated with Saint costumes or otherwise. Catholics celebrate the day of All Hallows Eve a little bit differently, but we focused on that last week. We talked with Adam Bly, an expert on demonology. So we asked the question, what are the first words of Jesus to the devil in the Bible? And we give you the hint that it's from the Gospel of Matthew. In the Bible, the first words Jesus says to the devil are, "Begone, Satan," or "Satan, begone." And that was Matthew chapter 4, verse 10, "Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." So that was the first quote of Jesus to the devil. Thanks for everyone who wrote in with that correct answer. This week, we're celebrating All Souls Day today, and every priest is allowed to celebrate how many holy masses on All Souls Day? So that's the question for this week. Every priest is allowed to celebrate how many holy masses? If you think you know that answer, one win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe you'll be the fastest with the right answer. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Meg Hunter-Kilmer about her brand new book series, Saints Around the World for Little Ones. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. There's a book that I really enjoyed about saints, and people who know me, who tune into the show, know I love talking about saints, and specifically American saints, and maybe even future American saints, those servants of God, venerables, and blesseds. But there's this great book that came out not too long ago called Saints Around the World, and it's written by Meg Hunter-Kilmer, who's a true expert on saints. And there's a new offshoot collection related to this same effort to talk about saints around the world, but it's specifically geared towards children. And it's called Saints Around the World for Little Ones. And it's a collection that's come out from St. Paul Center. And there are six books authored by Meg Hunter-Kilmer, and it's illustrated by Lindsay Sanders in this really unique style that brings the saints to life in a way that anybody can get excited about, but especially for young people. I think this book is a true home run. So we're so excited today, following the feast day of All Saints, and that is Meg Hunter-Kilmer. Welcome back to the program today, Meg.
Well, thanks. I'm always glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, and congratulations on this book series. I've seen these books. This is a wonderful Christmas gift, perhaps, or a gift for any time of year for parents or otherwise who want to give children sort of insight into the saints and to increase their devotion to the saints. So, congratulations on this beautiful series. Talk a little bit about how this came to be, going from the book Saints Around the World to this collection for children.
You know, it sounds funny, but it honestly started because I have some destructive children in my life who I knew I couldn't hand the real book to. Huh. So it, Saints Around the World is written for children, older children, you know, kind of a 7 and up, at least to read themselves. And it's got these beautiful pictures that little kids just adore. But it's large and just this lovely book, and you hand it to an 18-month-old, and even just trying to turn the page feels risky. Because it's an easy page to rip. And so from the beginning, we said, oh, we got to make something sturdier. We got to make something smaller so that you can hand it to a little kid who's just a little bit less careful in her page turning. And you don't have to worry about it. Something small that fits in the diaper bag. And then we figured, well, while we're making it small, let's make the stories shorter. Let's even put in a one-sentence summary on each story. So when you've got that 10-month-old who just wants to turn pages, which is a really important step in literacy, you've actually got something you can read instead of just the first half of the first sentence of your story. So worked on a series of saints who are from Saints Around the World, so they'll be familiar if you've read the longer book. But it's just been really beautiful to see the way little kids love the size of these books. They love holding them, carrying them around like their own little saints around the world. Been very sweet to watch.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book collection, and you've divided it up to, I think, 6 different books. Tell us a little bit about how you decided who made it into what book, and how you divvied up the saints in different ways that could appeal to different types of young people.
It was the trickiest brain teaser of my life. So I wanted to make sure that each book was still balanced for gender and ethnicity, so it didn't look as though white men could be adventurous, but women can be ordinary. You know, I didn't want to reinforce or introduce any new stereotypes. So trying to make sure that I had a good balance, that children could see a real diversity across personality types in these different categories, was definitely an exciting adventure. But I knew I wanted to have a book of royal and warrior saints. I thought that would be really appealing to a lot of children. I wanted to have a book with young saints, all of the saints that we have in there who died before the age of 25, to communicate that you can be a child and be a saint. And then from there, it was just a matter of figuring out how I could best balance the different types of people that we have. So we have ordinary saints, adventurous saints, unshakable saints, and talented saints. And some of these saints really could have gone in many of the volumes. It was just a matter of framing the story so that it highlighted that element of their identity.
Wonderful. We're talking today with Meg Hunter-Kilmer about a brand new book series, Saints Around the World for Little Ones. It's a collection from St. Paul Center, and it's a set of 6 books that is recommended for ages 4 to 8 children, and it really brings the saints alive. I think that, of course, your great knowledge of the saints and your storytelling abilities comes through in these books, but also the illustrations by Lindsay Sanders are quite remarkable, and I think are going to be attractive for children looking at these books. Talk a little bit about your collaboration with Lindsay.
Well, Lindsay is one of my best friends. I am godmother to her oldest daughter, and so it's a real gift, first of all, to be able to work with her on a project like this, but second of all, to work on a project with somebody that you trust so completely and who you respect so much. Lindsay isn't just a talented artist. She's also a really good researcher and has just a tremendous mind for detail. And so, you know, I'm thinking, oh, you can draw a picture of this thing. She's like, well, I need to figure out what kind of trees grow in his hometown so that I can include appropriate trees. And I like it. Would never even occur to me to do something like this. So the details are so precise. And then we were very intentional in cultures that we don't have a lot of familiarity with. We actually found people from those communities to look at the picture to say, hey, is there anything that stands out as not being suitable here? And we got some feedback. Actually, there was one Hmong saint who was holding a gong because he used to ring a gong to bring people to prayer. And a Hmong woman who I spoke to said, he can't be holding a gong, that's a pagan symbol. And I was like, oh, but he did. And she said, I understand that he did, but the symbol is a pagan symbol, and that's going to be problematic. And it was such a gift to hear that, because sure, maybe he rehabilitated this symbol, but that doesn't mean that a child is going to perceive it that way. And so to have all of that feedback to be able to make sure that these pictures really resonated with all kinds of children from all kinds of communities. And Lindsay's humility in just being able to receive that and be like, okay, well, I'll change it completely, was just amazing to see.
That's incredible. We're talking today with Meg Hunter-Kilmer about her brand new book series, Saints Around the World for Little Ones. And it's a derivative of her Saints Around the Book World book that was highly successful. And I encourage people to look at this book as a gift for young people in their life. And we're talking ages 4 to 8 at this point. And when you put this book together, Meg, Saints Around the World for Little Ones, or these books, did you, and I guess the same effort of choosing saints and highlighting saints went into creating the bigger book. It's all connected in some way. Did you have some favorite saints that that you assume that people had not heard of, but because of these books, these saints are going to get some attention going forward?
I do, and it's been really beautiful seeing the way that some of these stories have been received by children and some of the real fondness that's developed there. Sometimes those saints are really surprising, right? Like Saint Serapion the Sindonite is not a particular favorite of mine, but I think he makes a good story. So I put him in the book, and I had a woman reach out and tell me that she was trying to explain how excited she was about a particular feast day. And she said to her son, "No, it's like it's the feast day of Saint Serapion the Sindonite." And he looked at her and said, "Mom, who wouldn't be excited about the feast of Saint Serapion the Sindonite?" And I was like, literally everybody, buddy. Like, you're the only one. So that's been really beautiful to see. Some of my favorites, Blessed Columba Kangwon-suk is a divorced Korean wife, mother, and stepmother who was the absolute heart of the fledgling Catholic Church in Korea. I actually just led a pilgrimage to South Korea last month and was able to see artwork of her, able to go to the place where she went to Mass for the first time and to pray with her. And that was such a gift to me. And I know a number of adults who have really grown to love Columba Kangwon-suk because of reading about her in Saints Around the World. Saint Leopold Mandić was a Croatian Capuchin friar who just lived a very long life of unanswered prayer, which is tremendously encouraging to me in the midst of my unanswered prayers and seeing what faithfulness can look like when you don't pretend that you're okay with what God has done in your life, but you still continue to trust God and to love God. There are all kinds of folks in these books who I wasn't actually friends with before I wrote them. Like Columba Kangwon-suk, I had never heard of before writing Saints Around the World, and now she's one of my dearest friends. So this project has been a gift to me, probably far more than it has been to the rest of the world.
Amazing. We're talking today with Meg Hunter-Kilmer, and I like how you refer to the saints as friends, and that's how we want to present them to young people as well, and that's the purpose of these books, perhaps, is to allow people to increase their devotion and to be inspired by the saints, but also to develop spiritual friendships with these people who they've known, some they've known about, and some will be new to both the readers of the books and the young people themselves. And so, with that in mind, Meg, what is your hope, your dream for these books and how they're received?
I want kids to love Jesus. And I want them to know that holiness is possible for them because Jesus sees them in their entirety. He sees them exactly as they are, and he delights in them. So the saints are lovely. I really do like the saints quite a lot. I have spent a lot, thousands of hours researching and talking about the saints. But I like the saints because I love Jesus. And I think the saints point us back to the heart of Jesus. And the reason that friendship with the saints has been so important in my life is because it is always drawing me back to the deep and wild and fierce and tender love of God. So my hope with these children reading these books is that in seeing these saints, they just have it cemented in their minds that God is faithful to them and that God loves them in all of their particularities. And when they sin grievously, they think, well, St. Columba of Iona was a monk and got 3,000 people killed, so God can forgive me. And when there's profound brokenness in their family, they say, well, Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati's parents had a really difficult marriage, and God was taking care of him in the midst of that, so I know that he's present to me. All of these stories, I think, are just trying to shore up that reality of the love of God and of his faithfulness and of the fact that he delights in his people exactly as they are. And so my hope is that children become saints because they feel so rooted in the love of Jesus because of these stories.
Beautiful. Very well put. We're so grateful to you, Meg Hunter-Kilmer, for joining us on today's program and for putting together this book series, Saints Around the World for Little Ones, collection by St. Paul Center. This is available anywhere Catholic books are sold, but you can go to stpaulcenter.com or Amazon or anywhere else, like I said, that Catholic books are sold to pick these up. These make a beautiful gift for Christmas and otherwise. Well, we're so grateful to you, Meg Hunter-Kilmer, for joining us on today's program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
God bless. That was Meg Hunter-Kilmer. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Do you consider the miraculous ending of the Washington Commanders-Chicago Bears game a miracle? Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles and those things that relate to miracles happening all around the world. We had a funny question for me this week. I'm pretty sure this was written in by somebody who knows I'm a Chicago Bears fan, because it says, Dear Miracle Hunter, do you consider the end of the Washington Commanders-Chicago Bears game from Pat this last weekend a miracle? Thank you, Alex. Well, it's a good question. As I've mentioned, I am a Chicago Bears fan, so watching that game was a difficult one for me. And do I consider it miraculous? No, something else, of course. But for those people who didn't watch, on Sunday, rookie sensation Jaden Daniels threw a Hail Mary pass that stunned football fans. And was it the greatest play ever? And what can it teach us is the subject of various articles. But Sunday's game was one for the history books. The Chicago Bears were about to pull off a come-from-behind victory against the Washington Commanders, who were playing in their home stadium in Maryland. And the Bears had trailed the entire game, but they just scored a touchdown in a two-point conversion to take the lead 15-12 over the Commanders. And there were only 2 seconds left on the clock, and Washington was 60 yards away from its goal line when the ball was snapped. And the rookie quarterback, Jaden Daniels, and of course, the Bears have their own rookie quarterback, and everybody's wondering, should they have drafted this guy? But Jaden Daniels had to scramble and to dodge to avoid Bears defenders, and their only hope was for Daniels to throw a quote-unquote Hail Mary pass. And of course, that's a desperate pass to the end zone that you hope will be caught by a teammate, but it would be pretty much luck or a miracle if it ever connected. And it's just, of course, as likely to be caught by the defense for an interception. But Daniel scrambled around for 13 seconds, which seemed like an eternity. When he finally hurled the ball, everyone in the stadium was watching and holding their breath, and it was something of a sports miracle. The Jaden Daniels pass went 64 yards in the air before coming down just in front of the end zone, where if the defense had just let the ball drop or somebody catch it and tackle him, that would have been an easy end to the game. But the announcer said something like, here comes the Hail Mary with the game on the line. The ball is caught. It's a miracle. So we had the declaration of a miracle from Jim Nantz, the CBS announcer. And all the players leapt up, and the ball was tipped and actually went backwards into the end zone. And there was a player for the Washington Commanders, receiver Noah Brown, who was in the end zone. And the ball just popped up and landed in his hands. He caught it. Touchdown. Victory, the Commanders. In the words of Jim Nantz, it was a miracle. And the stadium erupted, and everybody in Chicago watching that game cried, including myself. But so do I consider this a miracle? No, but it was remarkable. I mean, it was a one-in-a-million kind of play. They try to do these plays all the time, and they never happen. So by percentage, it was very low. But for Bears fans especially, we wouldn't consider this thing a miracle. And do miracles ever happen in sports? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if God cheers for one team over another. If they did, of course, the team named after Our Lady, Notre Dame, would win all the games, but they don't. So anyway, that is the question of the week. Thanks for that fun one from Alex. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or questions@miraclehunter.com. We'll see if we can answer your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. Each week we talk about the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. And, of course, you all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion for each and every day of the calendar year. So for today's day, November 2nd, we've got appropriately Our Lady of the Souls from Rome in Italy from the year 1550. And the story goes that dedicated to the Virgin Mary as helper of souls in purgatory, the Church of Santa Maria della Anima became a place of worship for pilgrims when a Dutch couple in Rome began its construction in 1350. In celebration of the holy year of 1500, a group of statues, including that of the Madonna between two souls, was placed in the central tympanum. It was carved by Andrea Sansovino, and the statue was designed to follow the design of the image in a previous chapel on the site. And Santa Maria della Anima is currently the German National Church in Rome. Its wider construction features a traditional Northern European style with four apse chapels on each side. That is Our Lady of the Souls from Rome in Italy in the year 1550. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can connect to the website 365dayswithmary.com. You can pick up the book or download the free app, Marian Calendar, 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at the miracle of the day. We do this every week where we talk about a miracle that happened on the day's date somewhere in Christian history. And today we're talking about the miracle used for St. Padre Pio's beatification, the process for the case of Consiglia de Martino, a married woman with three children from Salerno in Italy. On October 31st, 1995, Consiglia began to feel acute pain, followed by a very fast-moving growth in her neck. When it quickly reached the size of a grapefruit, her husband drove her to the Riuniti Hospital in Salerno. After ordering two CAT scans, the examining physician determined that Consiglia's thoracic duct in her neck had ruptured, forming a huge lump containing approximately 2 liters of lymphatic fluid, and Consiglia was told that she would need to undergo a very difficult and complicated surgery as soon as possible. The surgery was scheduled for November 3rd. And Consiglia immediately began to pray to Padre Pio. She phoned his monastery at San Giovanni Rotondo, where she spoke with a priest there, a brother to whom Padre Pio had promised to help with intercessory prayers. And Fra Modestino, he prayed at the tomb of Padre Pio on November 2nd. And during that time, prior to the surgical intervention, physicians gave no medical treatment to Consiglia. On November 2nd, Consiglia noticed a marked decrease in pain, followed by a rapid diminution of the swelling in her neck. The following day, Consiglia was examined by physicians prior to the scheduled surgery, and they immediately noticed the disappearance of the swelling in her neck and ordered x-rays of that area as well as the abdomen. The x-rays showed the following: the complete cure of the rupture of the thoracic duct, the larger lymphatic vessel of the lymphatic system, which caused the lymphatic spilling, and the complete disappearance of the large 2-quart liquid deposit in her neck, and the complete disappearance of other liquid deposits in her abdomen. The surgery was canceled. The CAT scan for November 6th confirmed all these results of the x-rays taken on November 3rd, and evidently Consiglia had been immediately and inexplicably cured of a complex and dangerous condition without any medical intervention whatsoever. And she attributed the cure to Padre Pio, to whom she, her family, and Fra Modestino had been praying. And that's the miracle of the day for November 2nd, the miracle of Consiglia de Martino. That was the beatification miracle of Padre Pio. Let's take a look at, they might be saints. We talk about this each week where we talk about people on the path to sainthood and on the path to, we're talking about servants of God, venerables and blesseds on the path to sainthood. And so the might-be saint of the day is Blessed Luigi Campidello from Italy. He lived from 1868 to 1889. And for today's date, November 2nd, we have his memorial. He was born on April 29th, 1868, in Trebbio de Posio Berni in Rimini, Italy, as Luigi Campidello. He was the fourth of six children of Joseph and Filomena Belpani. He was known as a good student and extremely pious child, and he taught the catechism to other children. He's a member of the Passionists, and he took the name Pio and made his vows on April 30th, 1884. He is noted for piety and his devotion to the Eucharist and Mary. And while preparing for the priesthood, he died. He died on November 2nd, 1889, in San Vito de Romagna of tuberculosis, and he was buried in the churchyard in San Vito. His relics were interred in the sanctuary of Our Lady of Casale in 1923. He was declared venerable on March 21st, 1983, by Pope John Paul II in a decree of heroic virtue, and he was beatified on November 17th, 1985, also by Pope John Paul II. Currently, Blessed Luigi has one miracle under his belt. With a second miracle, he will be named a saint become Saint Luigi Campidello. And that is the Might Be Saint of the Day for today, November 2nd, Blessed Luigi Campidello. And on They Might Be Saints this week, we have an episode related to Monse Grasses. Each week, every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Central Time, my series They Might Be Saints airs on EWTN. And for this week, I examine the saintly life of Monse Grasses, the cheerful 17-year-old who faced cancer with extraordinary faith and joy and could be the first woman of Opus Dei to be declared a saint. And that one's coming up on this Wednesday at 8 a.m. Central Time. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at an interview with Dr. Robert Spitzer about Christ, science, and reason. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. One of my favorite topics to talk about on this program, of course, is science and the miraculous. That's, in fact, the name of one of my books that I've written, Science and the Miraculous. And there is someone who I consider to be perhaps the true expert in the United States when we talk about the intersection of faith and science. And that is Father Robert Spitzer. We've talked to him on previous programs here, and also he's been interviewed for my series on the Eucharist, Miracles of the Eucharist, which is forthcoming on EWTN. So check that one out. We had some great interviews at the Magis Center in California with Father Robert Spitzer. And for today's conversation, this is actually part two of a discussion we spoke a few weeks ago about the Shroud of Turin and some of the incredible research that has been done and some of the things that are truly mind-boggling about that purported burial cloth of Christ. And today we'll be speaking with Father Robert Spitzer about Eucharistic miracles, one of my favorite topics and a perfect topic for this time of year or this time of Eucharistic revival in our Catholic Church here in America. Welcome back to the program today, Father Robert Spitzer.
Michael, so good to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
It's always great to catch up with you, and I was so excited to see your book. The name of your book is Christ, Science, and Reason, What We Know About Miracles, What We Know About Jesus, Mary, and Miracles. And I think this is such a great book. I mean, it's right up my alley, and I'm sure it's right up the alley of many of the listeners here to this program on the Miracle Hunter Show. People want to know about how there's an interaction or an intersection between science and miracles. Talk to us a little bit about why you wrote this book that was pretty all-inclusive of the idea of science and miracles.
Well, in essence, I just wanted a single book under one cover that took a look at some of the remarkable scientifically investigated and with a great deal of verification as well of the Shroud of Turin, which tells us so much about the resurrection of Jesus, the passion of Jesus. It's really quite a remarkable, it's not just a historical artifact. It truly, in my view, is the burial cloth of Jesus. And it gives us so much about the passion and resurrection of Jesus. I also wanted to talk about the Eucharistic miracles, because today, more than any other period, we really have a chance to scientifically investigate and try to validate in many respects the miraculous nature of these hosts, which we'll talk about today. And then finally, with respect to the Marian miracles, of course, the Lord's healing miracles continue to go on and on. We have now the additional work of Dr. Jose Aste Tunsman on the image in the eyes of Our Lady in the Tilma of Guadalupe. We have, of course, the investigation of the miracle of the sun at Fatima that was done by Father Yaki, who is both a priest and a physicist. And that book, God and the Son in Fatima, just never got the play it deserved in terms of his attempt to look at not just the historical background of the miracle of Fatima, but also to look at the underlying science and the explanation of it and the resultant implications of a miracle some great, really almost cosmic proportion there. So, I mean, you have these, late 20th and even the early 20th and the 21st centuries are just filled with remarkable events where, you know, the Lord just didn't say, well, I guess science is here to explain everything. He had this ironic twist where he said, and science will help to see the non-naturalistically explicable, that is to say, the miraculous in nature. So, and that's, of course, associated with Jesus in the Shroud, our Holy Eucharist, and, of course, the Mary, our great advocate and mother and guide. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to put it all under one cover. There's just so much good science here. And, you know, obviously science can't prove a miracle because the whole point of a miracle is it's not scientifically and naturalistically explicable. And that's what science does. It uses empirical and mathematical methods to reveal it. But what science can do is give you a very reasonable access so that you can look at the preponderance of evidence and then make a judgment of this is reasonable and responsible in the light of the scientific methodology that we have to believe that right now there is no naturalistic explanation of these events, and there's unlikely to be a naturalistic explanation of these events in the future if our whole a view of physics is not to be completely altered. So, I mean, that's as good as you're going to come through the light of reason to seeing Jesus's, you know, glorious resurrection and his real presence in the Holy Eucharist, his, you know, body, blood, especially in the Holy Eucharist. And of course, Our Lady's, you know, intercession and her miraculous manifestation here in history as our advocate and guide.
Absolutely. And we've been talking today with Father Robert Spitzer about his brand new book, Christ, Science, and Reason, What We Can Know About Jesus, Mary, and Miracles, from Ignatius Press. And Father, let's just jump right into Eucharistic miracles. For me, this is such an important topic because when it comes to miracles, there's always an element of faith that you might say that goes into when somebody claims a vision of the Virgin Mary. There isn't necessarily a scientific proof or test that a vision is truly happening. And can you time it exactly if there were anyway? There are various types of miracles require some amount of faith in order to actually engage with them. And then we talk about Eucharistic miracles. And during this time of Eucharistic revival in our Catholic Church, this is an amazing thing to talk about, to bring people to belief in the Eucharist, the real presence of Jesus Christ. And we have on some very rare occasions, a very small number, less than 100, we would say, where true flesh and true blood has been made manifest on a consecrated Eucharistic host. And in that testing, we have found that all the samples around the world that have been scientifically tested come back to be the blood group AB. And there's other points of correspondence as far as the location in the heart, perhaps the heart muscle, and otherwise we see an amazing evidence. And I want to ask you, just out of the gate here, knowing what is known about Eucharistic miracles, what do we know that it can establish that these could not be hoaxes, that these could not be presented in such a way that there was a fraud?
Yeah, there are, I think, four elements that are important to look at in light of a recent scientific investigation. I think three of the miracles, the Buenos Aires Eucharistic miracle 1996, the Tixla miracle 2006, and the 2008 Sokolka, Poland miracle, do have tests and lab results and, you know, very, you know, esteemed people that are looking and examining these Eucharistic hosts that point to four things. First, you know, again, with respect to the miraculous nature, there seems to be heart tissue, living heart tissue, growing out of a consecrated host. Now, why use that term, growing out of? Because in the Sokolka, Poland Eucharistic miracle, there was electron microscopy, electron microscopic analysis that was done. You can get to a very, very, you know, deep level, I would call it, you know, with an electron microscope. You can get right down to the molecular level. with electron microscopes, and you can see a connection in this host. In this host in Poland, you can see that the living heart tissue that is connected with a very different substance, right? The substance of a consecrated host. And remember, that consecrated host still has its naturalistic accidents, as we would call them, in the Thomistic and Aristotelian healing philosophy. That is to say, the molecular structure of bread is still going to be present there. Now, what is so interesting is in this very different non-living substance, the consecrated host part, and in the heart tissue that is growing out of it, and I'll talk about why it's heart tissue in just a moment, you can see that they are connected on the level of the thin filaments of the myofibril. That is a very, very minute area of connection. You know, there's a few microns of separation between these two very different substances. Yet with this very small, interconnected space, you can see a very complex interweave, intertangling of the two different substances. Now, as both of the Polish doctors observed, Dr. Stanislaw Sulkowski and Dr. Elizabeth Lutkowska, both of them said, look, you're not going to get any kind of human technology that will be able to explain this. You know, NASA's technology, et cetera, cannot produce a living heart tissue growing out of a consecrated bread substance, right, that clearly are two different substances. So complex a weave and entanglement. Few microns of separation. This just isn't going to happen by any human technology. That helps to put this the Sokolka miracle beyond fraud. But, I would just start there because I don't think that one can be naturalistically explained. And you can almost disprove fraud because we right now as human beings with our technology can't produce it. The second thing that I think is important to note is that this really is heart tissue, and that has been validated, quite frankly, very well in all three cases. So you, Buenos Aires and Sokolka. And so the main thing to recognize is not only that this is, obviously morphologically it's heart tissue, right? You can see striations pretty clearly in Buenos Aires, and you can see the blood that is, I'll talk about the blood trickling out of the host, and you can see the segmentation and fragmentation, which is typical of heart tissue in the Sokolka host, just as the heart is, beating at the last minute, trying to stay alive amidst the throngs of death. You can see this sort of embedded in the tissue there in the Sokolka host. Now, what's so interesting about that, again, in the Sokolka, is you can't have this fragmenting and segmenting unless the tissue is alive. Similarly, in the Buenos Aires host and in the Tixla host, what we see are living white blood cells. Sometimes, they designated in a more refined way. It could be active macrophages. Sometimes the generic name leukocytes is used, but it's all referring to the same thing, that you have white blood cells of one kind or another that are truly operating, performing their healing activities, phagocytizing lipids or fat that is, going on there. And this can be detected through both light microscopy and electron microscopy. You can see that going on. Now, why is this so important that, this is taking place? Because white blood cells will not stay alive in a piece of flesh that is disconnected from an embodied circulatory system. Those white blood cells will not stay alive for more than a few hours, say 3, 4, 5 hours. How can these white blood cells, which have to be genetically connected to the tissue itself, right? How can these be alive and performing their functions in, say, the Tixla host or in the Buenos Aires host? How can, by the way, Dr. Zugabe validated that as well at New York University and Columbia University. He's the histopathologist up in New York City. The main thing, though, is how can these be kept alive in a tissue that is not living? The answer is it can't. I mean, it literally, what's keeping those white blood cells operating is the fact that they're in the living tissue that they are, trying to perform healing functions in. So that's the network, that's the nexus of its life. If the macrophages are alive, the white blood cells are alive, the tissue is likewise alive. Similarly, in the blood that is issuing from the Tixla host, we see red, living red blood cells. Again, the same, paradox, the same problem emerges. How can you have living red blood cells, issuing from, blood that is coming from this a little spongy tissue-like section of the host there at Tixla? How can this be present if that tissue and the blood itself, is not alive? And of course, blood that's disconnected from an embodied circulatory system is going to be dead. It is dead blood. And of course, its constituents, like red blood cells, will die, very quickly after the blood is no longer within that embodied circulatory system. Yet there it is in the Tixla host. So, again, we not only see that this is living heart tissue, but it's so refinedly connected to the substance of the host, it looks like the tissue is literally growing out of the host. I don't think this is possible, in terms of human technology. So for me, that's almost beyond fraud. And I think for Tsiolkovsky and Lutkowska, the two, scientific investigators there in Poland, histopathologists, it's clearly, beyond a fraud for them as well, since it can't be replicated by human technology. Again, how do you get the presence of heart tissue specifically heart tissue from the upper left ventricle, as Zugabe has identified it? And how in the world can that tissue be alive? And how in the world can you have living white blood cells in tissue, which seems obviously to be disconnected from an embodied circulatory system, continuing to operate years after it has been manifest, disconnected from any human body? All I can tell you is these things are not naturalistically and scientifically explicable. Last but not least, I think this heart tissue shows all of the connections of wounded living heart tissue. In the case of Tsiolkovsky, as I just explained, the fragmentation, segmentation in the tissue, this is kind of a unique occurrence. When a person is being tortured to the point of death, the heart right before death is beating, frantically to stay alive. You can actually see that. And then, of course, we have, as you pointed out already, Michael, you have AB blood type that is present. Obviously, this is not going to be paint or, something of that nature. And, when you have this number of hosts, with AB blood type, which is a very rare blood type, present, all these different so-called perpetrators of the fraud in diverse places like Tixla, Mexico, Buenos Aires, Argentina, and Tsiolkovsky, Poland, man, that must be quite a conspiracy to make sure that the blood type, a rare blood type, is always present. By the way, the same blood type is present on the Shroud of Turin. It's beginning to look interesting. Obviously, you have, one problem that has to be faced. And it troubles some people, but it does not trouble me. and that is the fact that you cannot amplify through polymerase chain reaction. You can't amplify a genetic profile, a specific DNA profile. We can detect through microscopy the presence of the molecular structures of DNA. You can see the remnants of DNA. It's clearly present. There is a process called polymerase chain reaction, PCR, that can typically amplify a DNA profile if the you have a big enough sample and a fresh enough sample. Well, in the case of the Tixla host, for example, there is definitely a big enough sample taken. And in that case, there's evidence that the blood is still alive. If you have red blood tissue, living red blood cells and living white blood cells present inside the blood, let me tell you this, that has to be living blood in which it exists, as I just explained. And if it has this, if it is living blood, that's a very fresh sample. You can't get much fresher than that. So you bring it in, you try and amplify it, and then you get to the vexing problem of it won't amplify a profile. Dr. Castagnon, Ricardo Castagnon Gomez, had it done twice in the labs. In the Tixla case, as I said, very clearly came from blood with living red blood cells in, and very fresh. And the same thing happened again. No amplifiable profile. This is
It's truly amazing, isn't it? The science of Eucharistic miracles is absolutely incredible. And we're so grateful to you, Father Robert Spitzer, for your new book, Christ, Science, and Reason, from Ignatius Press, and for talking to us today about this incredible, the existence of these miracles around the world is truly amazing and should be eye-opening and should be faith-inspiring for Catholics around the world who are science-minded to be inspired by these Eucharistic miracles that have been validated by science and show tremendous correspondence in these places all over the world, as you're saying, Buenos Aires, Tixla, Sokolka in Poland. You see correspondence from these very distant places around the world. So it's absolutely amazing. Well, we're so grateful to you, Father Robert Spitzer, for joining us on today's program.
And thanks so much again, Michael, for allowing me to go on and on there. And I truly appreciate the ability to tell people about these most, most remarkable hosts.
Absolutely. We're so grateful for the breakdown on Eucharistic miracles. Absolutely amazing. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio. Check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Meg Hunter-Kilmer, talking to us about saints around the world, and also Father Robert Spitzer in his new book, Christ, Science, and Reason, out from Ignatius Press. Check out my episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter, Pere Le Moniel, which airs on November 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I visit Pere Le Moniel in France, where St. Margaret Mary Ellicoque first experienced dramatic visions of Jesus' Sacred Heart. I explore the origins of this cherished devotion. Check that one out November 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth a hunt. Talk to you next week.